Michael Nicholson, room 12.
So that Monday, nothing. Tuesday, we tried the same routine again. Out in the morning on the light aircraft, circled, refused. Back for lunch. Out again on the Tuesday afternoon, circled the island, and refused. Wednesday morning, we circled the island, and they said, yes, we could land. So we were the first into Cyprus after the coup. And when we arrived, we were given complete freedom to film. We could see there'd been a mini civil war. Houses were smashed. There were still tanks on the streets. You know, the National Guard had its own tanks and personnel carriers and some pretty heavy artillery. There'd obviously been one hell of a fight. The buildings were riddled with machine gun bullets. There'd obviously been mortar fire. But it was now all over. And the Greek flag was flying from many buildings. So Monday morning we went out, Monday afternoon we flew out, Tuesday morning we flew out again, back to Tel Aviv, out in the afternoon on Tuesday, still the island said no. So I insisted on circling. I thought, well, let's keep going around and you know, keep insisting, and maybe they'll say yes. But then the pilot said, look, we're running out of fuel. We'll have to divert to Turkey to refuel. And so we did. We landed at a place called Adana. And it should have been a very ordinary landing, refueling stop, and off again to Turkey. But as soon as we landed, we were surrounded by the army. Armored personnel carrier turned up. Guns out, we were ordered out of the aircraft, you know, almost kind of hands up, escorted into the building, and they're given a fairly fierce interrogation, and which has, you know, astonished us. I mean, we were a civilian aircraft landing in part civilian, part military airfield, but, you know, we'd got permission to land, and here we were being treated as spies. And of course, that's exactly what the Turks thought we were. Because unknown to us, things were happening in Adana that were to have a very, very dramatic effect upon my life and the life of Cyprus, and I'll tell you about that later when I come to it. But we left Adana in quite a bit of a fright. Anyway, the following morning we left Tel Aviv again and did the same routine, and much to our surprise, Nicosia air traffic control said, yes, you're clear to land. And then we saw that there had been quite a fight. Buildings were smashed. There were still tanks on the streets. Buildings were still smouldering from fires. The Greek flag was flying from the public buildings. It looked as if the Greek colonels had won a very quick war. And Nikos Samson was now president of Cyprus. I interviewed him that afternoon. He was, you probably remember, he was a former IOCA terrorist who had assassinated and had boasted of assassinating many British soldiers. And here was this ex-car dealer, ex-killer, now president of Cyprus by permission of the Greek colonels in Athens. So we thought that was the end of the story. This was Friday now, and we thought our story was over. We were all preparing to pull out. I went to Nicosia Airport with my Nikos Samson interview and all the other bits and pieces that made up the story to fly to Tel Aviv to satellite it to London. But again, with this astonishing luck that I've had all my life, when, you know, bad luck somehow has transformed into good luck. I sat in the aircraft, and it was delayed and delayed and delayed. There was engine trouble and delayed further, and I was getting uptight and going to miss my satellite and everything else. And in the end, I said to Tom Fenton, who was the CBS correspondent, who was going to Tel Aviv in the next seat with me, I said, look, I'm going to get off. I'm not going to stick on this plane. Look, can you carry this film to me? There'll be a producer at the other end. He doesn't need me. I'll just fly out of Cyprus tomorrow. So he agreed, and he took my film back to Tel Aviv. A very sad departure for him, as it turned out. That night we had a party, a press party at the Ladera Palace, which is the the number one hotel there. And I went to bed rather the worse for wear. And at about, I suppose it must have been about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was woken up by a telephone call, and it was Peter Snow. Peter Snow, in the year 2001, works for the BBC, but then he worked for us. He was our diplomatic correspondent. And Peter, a most delightful man, also is a very cloak and daggerish man. He loves intrigue, and he said to me in almost a whisper, "Nick, I can't tell you too much because I don't know who's listening, but they are coming in tomorrow in the north at Saldanha Bay." Before I could kind of say what, he'd rung off. Now, I was in a very confused state. I'd had far too much Cyprus wine, Greek wine. But thankfully, the alarm bells rang again in my head, and I thought, well, by they, he must mean the Turks. If they are coming in, because the Greeks are already here. But Saldanha Bay in the north, he said. Well, I looked at the map, and Saldanha Bay, in fact, is south of the island. Cyprus looks like a frying pan, kind of elongated frying pan. And in fact, it's called the panhandle that goes up east towards Turkey. Saldanha Bay was on the south side of it. And I thought, well, if the Turks are coming in, surely they'll come in at the nearest point, if it's going to be a seaborne invasion. And that has to be Kyrenia, which is Turkish Cypriot anyway. So I had to make a choice. Do I go to Saldanha Bay or do I go to Kyrenia? So I thought, Kyrenia it has to be. I'll ignore. Peter must have got it wrong. One of us has got it wrong. I hope it's not me. So I tiptoed down the corridor so as I wouldn't wake up the BBC crews or anybody else. Got Alan Downs, my cameraman, Bob Hammond out of bed, and we quietly pushed the car out of the car park, and off we went from Nicosia towards northeast towards Kyrenia. Well, as it happened, because I thought I was pulling out that day, I hadn't bothered to refuel the car, hired car, and only about 5 miles outside of Nicosia, it may be more or less, I forget now, a village called Gonyeli, the car stopped, and fut, boom, and we looked at the petrol gauge, and it was empty. So you can imagine, here we were on our way to a world scoop, ahead of everybody else, and Nicholson had run out of petrol. So we were very stoic. At least we were for a while. When you're faced with total defeat, there's not much you can do except kind of accept it. And we decided to walk our way back to Nicosia, see if we can get another car. As we were walking back, we knew it was on because we were now in the Turkish Cypriot part of Cyprus. We'd gone the other side of the green line that separated the Greeks Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots. And we can see these people leaving their homes, going to shelters, carrying bedding, carrying their children, food, water. And we realized that they had picked up on the radio, their own Turkish radio station wavelength, that something was in the air, to coin a phrase. And this made us even more dispirited. We saw a car come along and kind of thumbed, and it was a BBC crew, John Bierman, and he gave us the kind of reverse victory sign which said, "Forget it, fella." Then a second car came along, it was Michael Sullivan of the BBC, and he gave us the same kind of response to our pleadings. So we were totally dejected. But half an hour later, still quite a long way from Nicosia, we suddenly heard a sound. And both Alan and I recognized the sound because both of us had been in Vietnam. Both of us traveled with the military on many occasions, and we knew the sound of a C-130, the big transport, four-engine transport planes, what we in the Royal Air Force called Hercules or Fat Alberts. And there they were, this huge formation of C-130s flying towards us. And as they got closer, little white pops, pop, 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 pop in the sky beneath them, pop, pop, pop. And then those little white pops became parachutes. And we suddenly realized that we had been expecting a seaborne invasion from Kyrenia. And maybe that was still to come. But the forward force were the paratroopers. And before our eyes, only a mile or so away, there they were landing. Now, it was too far for us to walk there. We tried to steal a car. It belonged to a nurse. She came out screaming and started to hit us over the head. And then suddenly a window opened in this village, and a man in his pajamas shouted out, "Hey, news at 10. Now, can you believe that? Middle of Cyprus, in the middle of an invasion, and a man in a pajamas opens up the window, sees a camera crew in his front garden, virtually, and he shouts out, "Hey, news at 10. Now, he then saw the paratroopers, and he said, "Ah, you want to go and see them?" And we said, "Actually, we do, yes. We would rather like to go and see them." So he came running down, and he had a brand new Volkswagen. So we all jumped into the Volkswagen, and still in his pajamas, he drove us up towards the landing, the parachutes, the landing ground. It turned out that he explained to us very excitedly that he'd been a student at the LSE and had been an avid watcher of News at 10 and had seen ITN on the side of the camera and thought, "Wow." And so he was terribly anxious to help us, as excited as we were. But then we hadn't gone more than a half a mile or so when we came to the Turkish roadblock, Turkish military roadblock, and there was no way they were going to let us film their landing. So again, so close and yet so far, you know, we had it within our grasp for the second time that morning, and we're about to lose it again. I mean, this is the ups and downs and the terror of being a war correspondent. So they said, "You follow us," and they had a small lorry, and out of the back of the lorry, they pointed their rifles at us and said, "You follow us." So off we went. Now, you can believe this or believe it not, but I once saw a movie with Alan Ladd in it. I'm sure it was Alan Ladd. Could have been Robert Mitchum. But exactly the same thing happened to him. He was in occupied France, a spy, was going somewhere and was caught by the Germans in his car, and they said exactly the same thing, "You follow us," and they pointed it. But then as he went through a village, he told the driver of his car to slow down once the lorry in front was just round the bend. As it turned a sharp bend, stopped the car, and he jumped out, and that's what we did. Said to the driver, "Next, when we go through this village, let the car lorry ahead just go a little way ahead, out of sight, stop the car, and we're going to jump." And then we did. We ran through the village, went through, a baker's shop. The guy was still baking bread, and we ran straight through his kitchen, and out into the fields with a paratrooper still dropping. And I think it's been immortalized on camera because as we came to the first paratrooper, I said to him, "Michael Nicholson, ITN, welcome to Cyprus." And it was all on film, and it was transmitted as such. But people always say, "Well, that was very theatrical, wasn't it?" But it wasn't theatre. I think what went through my mind at the time was that if you were a paratrooper landing in hostile territory, you know, and you're 100 feet, 200 feet above, and you look down, and you suddenly see one man with this huge thing on his shoulder pointing it at you, another man with what we call a rifle mic, you know, one of these long microphones pointing it at you. You think, "Well, I'll shoot first and see who they are later." But if you see another man, a third man, jumping up and down hysterically, waving his arms and smiling, well, then you're likely to relax a bit, which is the purpose. That was why I did it. So I rushed around looking terribly friendly to everybody. And again, I saw an officer. By that time, of course, you know, the flags were up and all the kit was landing. And I saw an officer, and we ran up to him. And as luck would happen again, he spoke English. It was one of those days, you know. And I interviewed him short. He didn't have much to say, but it was an interview in English with a Turkish paratrooper landing in Cyprus. So we filmed it all there was to film. Children were coming out of the villages, helping to carry the ammunition boxes, helping to carry the guys' ammunition boats. Women were bringing out water. These were all Turkish Cypriots, of course, welcoming their troops, bringing out water, bringing out fresh bread. It was an astonishing, almost festive. And then it suddenly changed very dramatically, because by that time, the Greek Cypriots and the Greeks in charge of the National Guards had got their artillery sightings, and they started to pound us. So we rushed into this village, Gonyeli again. I think the local church had become a kind of field hospital, because the Turks were already taking casualties. And some idiot Turk had hoisted this huge red Turkish flag on the roof, so it gave the Greek artillery gunners a wonderful target to hit. So we decided after a little while of this that we weren't going to sit in the trench all day. We moved off a little way away, and I think it was a kind of old, it must have been an old bakery, because there were these kind of old disused ovens there, which gave us shelter. Maybe they were wine storage, but it was a kind of well-protected, well-built building, and we crouched in there, thinking that was it, thinking the story, you know, we'd got everything we could expect to get. When again we heard this familiar sound, I knew what it was, and so did Alan, again because we'd been in Vietnam, and it was this very characteristic sound of the Huey helicopter. And we looked east again, and it came like a huge swarm of, a huge swarm of bees. That's what they looked like. Some of them almost touching the ground and then kind of spreading back behind in formation up to about 1,000 feet. Boom, 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 boom. In they came. I mean, I lost count of how many there were. And out tumbled more Turks taking up positions. We filmed all this. So there we had it. I did a piece to camera. Rather hysterically, as you can imagine. Shot into the sun, so I'm looking terribly dark, but, you know, it was all happening so quickly. And I actually, I think I recorded the date, and I certainly recorded the time. I had a habit in those days of always looking at my watch and actually saying, it's now 7:30 on the whatever it was. I often think that if I hadn't had a watch, I'd have been speechless in those days, but it was all recorded. I wanted to make sure that people realized that it was happening, and we were there, and this was the time, right down to the minute. So then it was time we decided to pull out. We didn't want to be in the middle of a battlefield, which is where we were. It was time to find safety, and if possible, get back to Nicosia. So we packed our gear, and off we went. Can you just pause there? Yeah. We stayed for a while in that kind of oven type place, but realized that if we were going to move, we had to move then while it was still light. We were expecting to be in the middle of a battlefield. We had no cover, you know, we had no helmets, no flak jackets, nothing. And if we were going to move, we had to move while it was light. But, you know, how could we move with so much artillery, so many shells landing? Then, I suppose it must have been around about 4, in the afternoon. I know the summer's very, very red, so I think it must have been late afternoon. The guns stopped. The Greek artillery stopped. Everything was silent. I mean, 10,000 Turks had landed on the island, and all of a sudden, the Greeks had stopped firing at them. This gave us the opportunity then to start moving along the road. We hadn't gone more than, a mile or so when the Greeks started firing again. And one of the, and the shells were, they weren't firing at us, of course, but the shells were landing around us. I mean, not big stuff, it was probably 105s, big enough to decapitate us. But there was a little trick that we learnt in Vietnam. So we took our shoes off. The gravel roads were very noisy, but if you took your shoes off, you could actually hear the boom of a mortar or a gun as it fired. So when you hear that, you know you've got a few seconds, and we would then dive down up below the level of the road until the shell landed. And then we get up and go again. We heard that boom, and down we go again. And eventually, we crossed no man's land. You know, that piece of land between the two sides. How we did it, I don't know. It was just miraculous because, you know, it's flat territory there. It's not, you know, we couldn't hide behind gorse bushes or run along trenches or riverbeds. It was open ground.
Would it have been dark at this
time? No. It was dark, and we would have been totally lost. But no, it was still light. It was dusk, and I just don't understand how we did it. We crossed no man's land. I mean, maybe both sides were. Of course, we were leaving the Turks, so the Turks wouldn't have been firing at us. But we were approaching the Greeks, and they obviously would have fired at us. But maybe the sight of three rather bedraggled, dirty, totally exhausted Englishmen in their socks crouching along the road must have taken everyone by surprise, because we eventually reached a police station and were given an escort back into the Ledra Palace, where, of course, there was all the very despondent journalists who not, you know, been encased in the hotel all day and not being allowed to leave once. We had, of course, to keep everything very quiet. You know, we didn't enter and say, guess what we've got, guys. We had to keep it quiet because, you know, I've been in the business, even then I've been in the business long enough to know that there are plenty of disgruntled, snide guys in the business who, if they had learnt, especially, you know, the opposition, the BBC, had they learnt what we'd got, instead of congratulating us, slapping us on the back, would have then told the Greek authorities. If they hadn't got the scoop, then nobody else would. So we had to keep it very, very quiet. Now, there was another ITN crew there at the time, Chris Wayne, John Collins, Tony Piddington, and they'd filmed their own little story. Apparently there'd been some kind of gunfight around the hotel that day, so they'd got their little story. So we there ensconced, we then went down into the cellar of the hotel, and had to decide what we were going to do next, how we were going to get the film out. That was now the number one priority. You know, it's getting the story. You get it by luck, and we got it by luck that day. Enormous luck, probably the best luck I've ever had. You know, turning that bad luck, running out of petrol and everything else. We'd now got a world scoop. Nobody else had got it, you see. It was too far away. But now was the really difficult part. Well, we couldn't depend upon luck. We had to depend upon our own planning, our own engineering, our own cunning. As Don McCullen once very kindly said to me, I always admired his ability to get into a story. No, it wasn't Don, it was Sandy Gall. I always admired his ability not only to get the story, but to get it out. And that was the problem now. How are we going to get our story out to London, surrounded as we were by two fighting armies? So we had a kind of little old group. I sent Alan Downs out into the car park. It's by dark now, of course, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, to siphon off as much petrol as he could from the other cars, in the press cars in the car park, and fill up our own car. There was a Union Jack flying from the flagpole, which we borrowed, took that down. We had the white sheet, and we had two white pillowcases, and I was in a toss-up about who would take the film out of the hotel to Acre Tiri, which was the British Royal Air Force base at the other end of the island, the west end of the island. And that was our only way out. That was the only way we would ever get it out. And we assumed that the Royal Air Force was still flying in and out of Cyprus from Acre Tiri. I was quite prepared to do it, but Chris Wayne, God bless him, said no, he would go. He would take the film. So we took it, put our two separate stories into two separate pillowcases. We strung the Union Jack across the front of the car and the white sheet above the roof of the car. Another pillowcase we tied to the radio aerial, so it was pretty obvious who we were, and hid the two pillowcases in separate parts of the car in case, you know, one was found, and waited. We just waited now for the opportunity to leave. And again, God send, the United Nations, early that morning, about 4 or 5 that morning, suddenly alerted everybody that they'd negotiated a ceasefire between the two sides for 1 hour in order to enable us, the press corps, and any other tourists, foreign nationals in the Labour Parish, to get out and go to the Hilton, which was further out, away from the Green Line, a safer place. And that was going to happen at 10, so there was our opportunity. Everyone was going to leave the hotel under United Nations security at 10 o'clock. We would be among them. But one of our cars would, in fact, go straight on to Acre Tiri. And that's what happened. I have to say, some of those cars never did leave the car park because they suddenly found they had no petrol in their tanks. Chris had a hell of a job, but he got through to Acre Tiri, and, you know, it was a hell of a job because, you know, it wasn't a simple division. You know, one half is Greek Turks, a Greek Cypriots, and one half is Turkish Cypriots. You know, so you'd have a Turkish Cypriot village, and then the next one would be a Greek Cypriot village, and they're bound to have their own barricades up. They're bound to be exchanging fire between each other. But Chris did get through, and with that, and this capped it all. This capped what was, you know, the most astonishing 2 days of my life, I suppose. As Chris got into Acre Tiri Air Base, he saw a Royal Air Force VC-10 taxiing along the runway for takeoff. And being a quick-thinking fella, went straight to movements in air traffic control and said, "Where's it going?" They said, "Bryce Norton." Chris blurted out the story, what we'd got, who we were, what we'd got, and how vital it was to get it to London. And God bless them, the Royal Air Force told the captain of the aircraft. He waited. They threw the two pillowcases to him. He took off, and a few hours later, he was landing in Bryce Norton. And it was called, I think it was Safe Hands of Captain, Safe Hands, oh, shock, Safe Hands of Captain. Everything was alerted, of course, at the London end. The customs just waved it through. It was handed to a helicopter pilot who flew it from Bryce Norton to Battersea. At Battersea, we had our dispatch rider waiting, who then zoomed it across London to ITN House. And it was on the news at 10 that night. A world scoop, a world exclusive. And it was just quite extraordinary.